Chapter 24. After the Jarapta left with their demonstrator ships, Skippy got the fabricators and our three fleet support ships working to crank out the stuff we needed. What was our first priority? The battleships or battle cruisers? No. They were important, but even with the upgrades we planned to install, they could not travel long distances on their own. Okay, then, how about the four star carriers? Again, no. The six assault troopers, since we expected the Alien Legion to be going into action? No, not them either. Our first priority was to plan for the future. So, Skippy got the fabricators busy, making parts to construct more fabricators. Even the sophisticated machines of the fleet support ships could not completely replicate themselves. They required exotic materials that the fabricators could not create from ordinary raw materials. For that reason, the space dock we acquired included two huge containers of spare parts and a bin that was crammed full of exotic metals and ceramics the fabricators couldn't create. UNEF's plan was to create another complete set of fabricators to bring to Earth while the three fleet support ships remained at Farm Jaguar. If you really need to know the boring details of UNEF's implementation plan, the second priority was to get two of the star carriers operational, then four of the assault carriers, then the battle cruisers, and on down the list. We hadn't requested any frigates because anything a frigate can do, a destroyer can do better. Fleets have frigates because they are cheap to build and operate. We didn't have that concern. Not yet. Someday, when we filthy monkeys are building our own ships, resource constraints and budgets will be an issue. I look forward to the days when our biggest concern is which corporation gets the juiciest contracts. Anyway, Skippy got the fabricators working properly, figured out how to instruct them to create the parts we needed first, then trained Nagatha how to take over. She was already busy managing the space dock that had come to us in sections attached to a star carrier with some assembly required. To no one's surprise, the handy-dandy instructions on how to put the damn thing together were not quite correct. It is difficult to put tab A into slot B when there is no slot B to be found, and tab A is bent out of shape. For the first time, Nagatha snapped at me when I asked her for a status update. She was under a lot of stress, and understandably extra irritated with Skippy. Unfortunately, the only way in and out of Fob Jaguar was by Skippy screwing with a wormhole, and we could not halt operations every time we came up for air, as we called going back to the galaxy to see what was going on. My vacation at Club Skippy came to an end when Skippy reported that Nagatha was fully capable of handling the fabricators and anything else that needed to be done at Fob Jaguar. To be sure that Skippy was not bailing early because he was bored, I asked Nagatha if she was ready, if there was anything she needed, anything I could do for her. She replied that yes, she was ready, and could I please take Skippy somewhere else so he did not drive her crazy by watching everything she did. I took the hint. It was time for us to get an update anyway. The Jarapta should have evaluated the demonstrator ships and decided they were either in or out of a more comprehensive deal with us. It was time for Valkyrie to return to the world, as people of Fob Jaguar called the galaxy beyond the closest wormhole. Oh, I had a nice surprise. Jennifer Sims came with me for the flight back. She had been tasked with reporting back to Earth on the progress made in setting up a forward operating base and lessons learned, and also to knock some sense into the supply people on Earth who were sending twice as much of stuff she didn't need and not enough of stuff she did need. I wished her luck. Escorted by a squadron of destroyers, the former ECO ship Rock Solid and Suspiciously Convenient Alibi jumped into the designated emergent zone, just outside the next star system on its tour of the region. After testing at the regional capital planet Gizvagen, the Alibi was released back through the wormhole for more extensive testing by the Jarapta home fleet. When those tests were concluded successfully, the old ship and the two other demonstrators were sent on a goodwill tour of planets that were politically influential to gather support for a future alliance with humans. The ship would spend several days in orbit, with VIPs coming aboard for short flights to demonstrate the amazing new technologies offered by the humans. Then the ship would jump away to the next stop on the tour. So far, the Alibi had visited three star systems on the widely publicized tour, and the demand to see the ship in action had been so overwhelming, a second crew had been assigned to allow the ship to operate around the clock. Support for an alliance with humans was building with every stop along the tour, based on the sagging odds being wagered against the Jarraptha signing a treaty with Earth. Three more stops, the Alibi's weary crew told themselves. Only three more planets to visit, then the ship would be brought to a shipyard for maintenance, and the crew could get a break. First, the ship and escorting squadron had to go through the formality of waiting at the designated emergent zone to obtain clearance to approach the heavily populated second planet in the system. The lead destroyer already had a full set of authentication codes to prevent the planet's strategic defense network from firing on intruders, so the wait was truly a formality, an annoying delay to acknowledge the authority of the local government. At least the squadron would not have to pay the usual bribes at the clearance station, which irritated the crews who anticipated skimming off part of the bribes for themselves. That is what happens, the crews told themselves, when the Inquisitor's office is watching too closely. Everything went exactly as planned when the rock-solid and suspiciously convenient Alibi emerged in the center of the formation, with the six destroyers popping into existence to form a bubble around the precious demonstrator. The lead destroyer pinged the clearance station that hung in cold, dark space so far from the local star that it was merely a faint disk. Then the ships checked their systems while they waited for the formal invitation to jump inward. Absolutely not as planned. A task force of Bosphorak warships jumped in to surround the squadron, focusing damping fields only on the demonstrator and blasting the escorting destroyers with maser cannons and particle beams. The senior captain in command of the squadron immediately recognized the danger, and almost as immediately recognized there was not much that her six destroyers could do to protect the Alibi. The enemy force consisted of four battlecruisers, nine light cruisers, and 14 destroyers, a strike package selected for speed and maneuverability. With the enemy's transmitters hammering space with powerful jamming fields, she sent an unencrypted message to the Alibi, ordering that ship's crew to get into escape pods and set the precious demonstrator to self-destruct. Too late. Her destroyer was rocked by maser bolts that flared the shields and blew power couplings throughout the ship as the four battlecruisers closed on the Alibi. One of the battlecruisers fired maser cannons in a broadside, six big-bore cannons focused on the narrow section of the Alibi's forward hull. The hellish directed energy quickly burned through the shields, the outer armor plating, the thin pressure hull, and finally the frames that held the hull together. The old ship was sliced in two pieces, the larger engineering section of the Alibi drifting away from the spinning forward hull for a moment before the battlecruisers all fired to vaporize the crew section. To her horror, the squadron commander saw the remainder of the demonstrator ship was not responding to self-destruct commands, and two battlecruisers had moved in to block the Jarraptha escorts from firing on their fellow ship. Reluctantly, with her ship's AI announcing that they had to jump away now before the jump drive was compromised, she gave the order to retreat. The destroyer squadron jumped a short distance, far enough to safely take a few minutes for diagnostic tests of vital systems, close enough to watch the alarming, time-delayed sensor images of a Bosphorak battlecruiser latch onto the Alibi's engineering section. The battlecruiser was equipped with an odd grappling contraption for pulling in and securing a smaller ship, or part of a smaller ship. Clearly, the Bosphorak had carefully planned the operation to steal the demonstrator. There was still hope that the backup computer systems in the rear section of the Alibi would activate a self-destruct mechanism. That hope held, right up to the moment when the enemy task force disappeared in a burst of gamma rays. Well, fuck! Senior Captain Gamaria swore. This is a damned mess! She scowled as she reviewed sensor data, attempting to get a clue about where the enemy task force had gone. Her squadron of damaged destroyers had to make an effort to track the stolen demonstrator, no matter how hopeless the operation would be. Certainly, the Bosphorak had a star carrier waiting nearby to swiftly fly the task force far away. Even if her squadron could pinpoint where the task force had gone, the enemy would be long gone by the time she could pursue. It had been many months since the squadron had practiced a combat latching maneuver to quickly dock with the star carrier, and their assigned star carrier was not even certified for combat latching. That was a mistake, one of many mistakes that she would get blamed for, despite her numerous objections when the operational plan was explained to her. the tour schedule should not have been so public. There should not have been a public tour at all. If there had to be a public tour, the Alibi's escort should have been composed of more and heavier ships, and the assigned star carrier should not have been an old fleet auxiliary rust bucket that had been hauling nothing but ore containers for the past 4 years. Anything? She looked around the destroyer's bridge. Her ship was battered but flightworthy, though she wouldn't want to engage anything larger than a frigate. The crew only shook their heads. Many of the exterior sensors had been baked by maser fire. They could not discern any useful information from the fading gamma rays of the enemy jump wormholes. All right. She adjusted the sensors to focus on debris from the Alibi. Along with the expected shattered fragments of composites were bits of organic matter. Body parts. There were no survivors. The Bosphorok Imperial battlecruiser Regent of Kalistah was a beehive of frantic activity. Dropships clustered on and around the shattered Jarapatha hull section that was attached to the big battlecruiser, and technicians and bots swarmed inside the engineering section of the captured demonstrator ship. The first priority was to disable any self-destruct mechanisms inside the prize, then download every bit of data from information storage systems and transmit the data to other ships. With the self-destruct charges disabled or removed completely, teams connected cables to the main computer, and soon, petabytes of information were surging out on tight-beam laser links. A second star carrier was keeping formation at a safe distance, its attached ships all taking in the data and watching for enemy ships that would surely be searching for them. As a precaution, two battlecruisers had detached from their star carrier and were ready to intercept any ship that jumped in, while both star carriers kept their jump drives on a hair trigger for immediate use. Data storage and processing systems aboard the captured ship that could not quickly be accessed simply had their substrates cut out of the hull and brought to waiting dropships, which raced away as soon as they were loaded. The Bosphorok Empire had suffered terribly from unfair punishment by their patrons and could not afford to fall further behind in the technology race against the Jarapatha. If some or most of the Bosphorok involved also hoped the captured technology would eventually enable them to tell their hateful patrons to go screw themselves, well, that was understandable. Communication and Information Systems Technician Level 4 Argus Flemerin reminded himself to be patient as his ultra-fine laser cutting torch sliced through a bulkhead and interior frame. His goal was to get access to and remove part of the ship's jump drive control system. Unlike most of the computers aboard the prize, it was not software or data that his people needed. It was the processing hardware itself. The technology possessed by humans allowed ships to jump farther, more frequently, and with far greater precision using less power. Ships with the new drive control system supposedly had a limited capability to jump even within the boundary of a damping field, though Flemerin was skeptical of that. The Jarapatha ship had not jumped away when trapped within overlapping damping fields. Yes, the combined damping power of four battlecruisers had been focused on the little ship, but Flemerin would have been more impressed if the little ship had at least attempted to jump away. No matter. He had an assignment, and he was performing it to the best of his ability. With the bulkhead cut away, he could see the casing of the processor. Switching to a diamond-tipped cutter to avoid overheating the unknown but possibly delicate alien components inside the casing, he examined the scanner display, deciding the best places to cut. It looked like the processor had only four external connections. The cutter went to work, easily slicing through one of the connections. As the Level 4 technician pulled himself along the bulkhead in zero gravity to reach the next connection, he missed seeing a tiny yellow light blinking on the casing. Cutting the connection activated a hidden subroutine inside the processor. There were seven other similar processors scattered throughout the engineering section. Any of them could have initiated the process. Flemerin simply had the luck, or lack of it, to be first to cut through a connecting cable. One of the first acts of the Bosphorok crews when they boarded the prize was to safe the power stored in the captured ship's jump drive coils. They did that to prevent an accident and to avoid the stored energy from being used as a self-destruct mechanism. The procedures they expertly followed were precisely correct for any normal type of jump drive coils. The coils aboard the rock-solid and suspiciously convenient alibi were very much not normal, which the technicians perhaps should have considered, as that was the whole point to capturing the technology demonstrator in the first place. 3 milliseconds after the yellow indicator light blinked, the alibi ceased to exist in a blinding flash of short-lived radiation as energy that was supposed to create a tear in space-time was released. When the captured ship exploded, it took with it the battlecruiser Regent of Kalista, another battlecruiser, 3 light cruisers, 4 destroyers, and the star carrier they were all attached to. Regardless of how many ships were lost, the Bosphorak considered the operation to be an outstanding success. The data and components retrieved from the demonstrator were safely aboard the 2nd star carrier, which jumped away immediately, as did the 2 battlecruisers that were protecting the formation. The Jurapha troop transport We Avoid Temptation But It Keeps Finding Us lifted from Earth orbit to great fanfare, though the excitement and celebration was confined to the human passengers, because the Jurapha crew was not enthusiastic about leaving behind all the juicy action of the human planet. The Temptation had been scheduled to depart 3 days before it did, the delay being required to locate and retrieve 19 Jurapha crew members who jumped ship. Those who went AWOL, or simply failed to return when their 2-day leave expired, tried to hide until their ship jumped away. Which is rather impressive, given that each of the miscreants was a 3-meter-long beetle with a green leathery exoskeleton and a compulsion for gambling. Most of the attempted ship jumpers were located in areas near major casinos, Las Vegas, Macau, Monaco, and the other usual suspects. One was found hiding in the back room of an Indian casino in upstate New York, where apparently she had been playing poker nonstop for 32 hours and had lost all of her officially issued gear. One was found in a private casino on a yacht anchored off the south of France. Others were more creative in their pursuit of action. 2 were found huddled inside the Green Monster left field wall at Fenway Park, wagering with each other about the outcome of games, innings, and individual pitches. And the last miscreant had to be dragged from the ladies' bingo night at the volunteer firefighter station in a small town along Interstate 20 in northwest Nebraska. The ladies were sorry to see him go. He had provided great entertainment and lost enough money to pay for a new pumper truck. When the Temptation fired its engines to climb to jump altitude, the human passengers were excited, many of them appearing on video to speak with audiences in their home countries. They were going to the planet Paradise, though almost everyone remembered to refer to that world by its proper name, Gitanu, to avoid showing any disrespect to the Ruhar. The 327 humans, a number comfortably below the firm limit of 500 established by the Ruhar, were mostly civilians. It was thought that sending civilians instead of military personnel would allay the fears of the Ruhar that humans did not intend to ever leave Paradise. 4 months was the maximum time the Ruhar would allow the official United Nations survey and assessment team to remain as guests on the world where humans had originally arrived as lackeys of the Kristang. To sell the notion that the United Nations team did not intend to stay indefinitely, they brought with them only enough food for 6 months. The other supplies in the Temptation's cargo bays were luxury items, such as coffee, chocolate, and other foods that Ruhar technology had not quite been able to replicate. In terms of momentous events, the human landing on Paradise was ages ago. But to some of the Ruhar population, especially longtime residents of that world, feelings were still raw. Humans were still not entirely trusted. It did not help that the Ruhar suddenly had a massive chip on their fuzzy shoulders. The humans had been annoying and somewhat pathetic primitives, objects of scorn and pity. Occasionally, some small groups of humans did something admirable, but that was the exception. Sure, the Mavericks had managed to bring about the downfall of the Ruhar federal government after the shameful incident on Fresno. That also was an anomaly. Now, the humans were coming to Paradise as one of the 3 most powerful species in the galaxy, a force to be reckoned with. All 327 of the survey and assessment team were selected for their ability to be non-confrontational and trained in diplomacy and de-escalation techniques. They all had been instructed that in their dealings with the Ruhar, they should affect an "aw shucks, we just got lucky" attitude. humans were still young and primitive and needed the wisdom and guidance of the Ruhar. Anyone who couldn't stomach the idea of bowing to aliens was left off the UN team. The temptation accelerated slowly, gaining speed and so lifting away from the human homeworld toward jump distance. The ship moved slowly, not because it was heavy. The few passengers aboard and their cargo was barely noticeable compared to carrying a full cavalry brigade and all its equipment. The slow progress was because the Temptation's captain and many of the crew were nursing whopping hangovers from their own shore leaves, and the captain was not entirely sure that her crew had not stripped vital equipment off the ship to use for gambling. One of the reactors was running at idle because several relays were missing, along with the power conduits from that reactor. All the ship's captain wanted was to jump and latch onto a star carrier waiting at the edge of the star system. Then she planned to sleep for a full day. Miraculously, because it was discovered at the last minute that a cluster of jump drive coils had been stolen and replaced by fabricated fakes, the troop ship successfully jumped without further delay. A day later, it was firmly attached to a hardpoint of the home fleet star carrier. You should have thought of that before we left home, and both crew and passengers could relax for the journey to paradise. The Maxalt's offensive against Earth began not with weapons fire, but with diplomacy. The Rindaloo were approached and provided with the broad outline of the plan of escalating harassment against Earth. The Maxalt's diplomats, once they gained permission for a meeting, emphasized two factors that were likely to gain approval from the Spiders. First, that the Maxalt's hegemony needed to take action against the unpredictably dangerous humans for the security of both apex species. Second, and almost as important, that the Spiders did not have to actually do anything. The Rindaloo always were more responsive to a proposal when they were not requested to expend any effort. That is why the first shot fired in the campaign against humans was in the form of a politely worded diplomatic memo. "Commodore, please come in." Planetary Administrator Logelia gestured to the Navy officer with a mixture of curiosity and concern. Commodore Sequence Squadron had jumped into orbit only an hour before, and a priority message requested an urgent meeting with her, so she had cleared her calendar.
"Administrator." He glanced left and right, checking if any of her staff was in the office, but they were alone. The door slid closed behind him. "Thank you for seeing me on such short notice."
"Did I have a choice?"
"No. I don't wish to alarm you. There is no imminent threat to this world or any of our territory." "No threat other than the usual, of course," he added.
Since the astonishing revelation that humans had been flying around the galaxy in a series of stolen starships and now possessed elder weapons, the galaxy had maintained an uneasy peace. Each species was trying to understand the new strategic situation, and each species was pondering how to take advantage of the new reality. The Kristang were particularly quiet, consumed by their own internal war that had been given new life through interference by the Alien Legion. The Ruhar government had called a halt to all offensive operations, pulling the fleet back into a defensive posture while the politicians argued about what the hell to do next.
"Then why the urgency?"
"Before I explain, I suggest you summon the human ambassador to meet with us. This concerns the humans directly."
If Administrator Logelia was curious and anxious about an urgent request from Commodore Sequent, Ambassador Chotek experienced only anxiety when he was called to meet with the local Ruhar official. He was exhausted with a combination of jet lag and disorientation from flying back and forth across the galaxy in a courier ship provided by the Jarratha. In his experience, last-minute meetings, especially those at the highest level, were never good news. He left his two staffers in the building's lobby and proceeded through security to be escorted up to the administrator's office. She was waiting for him. The other person in the office was a Ruhar naval officer who Hans had never met. The officer's insignia designated him as a Commodore. That was the only clue Hans was able to learn from looking at the alien. Introductions were made, pleasantries exchanged, and Sequent got right to business.
"Ambassador Chotek, I am required by my government to notify you that the Rindaloo recently stated they will not protect us under the terms of our mutual defense treaty if we continue to pursue an alliance with humans. Chotek's training and his natural reserve allowed a cool response.
I see. That is an interesting development, he said.
Such a neutral statement filled the awkward gap in the conversation and gave him time to think.
Has your government decided how to respond?
It is under consideration, Sequent said after his eyes darted to Logelia.
Of course.
Another neutral statement.
Unfortunately.
Logelia took over the conversation with a nod to the military officer.
My government has directed that, for this interim period, we must pause all negotiations regarding the human presence on this world.
I understand. Do you have instructions about the UNEF survey and assessment team which should be on their way here now? A Jarapta transport was supposed to have departed from Earth with up to 500 mostly civilians. The limit of 500 had been a compromise after delicate negotiations, with the Ruhar seeking to minimize the number of humans coming to their world and UNEF eager to maintain a presence on Paradise. If humans were only seen leaving the planet, it would be all too easy for the Ruhar to refuse to allow replacement battalions to rotate in. Hans knew Logelia was in an uncomfortable position, having to balance interstellar and local politics. Some of the residents of Paradise saw the presence of humans as good for business. Others feared the human presence made their world a target. And others wanted all of the humans gone for the simple reason that them leaving meant the areas they currently occupied would become available for development. For now, Sequent spoke, because it was a military issue. The people coming from Earth will need to remain in orbit, pending further developments.
That could be problematic, Hans said softly, if the Jarapta insist their ship remain on schedule.
He was hoping to gain a concession that, if necessary, the incoming humans could temporarily be allowed to land. Getting boots on the ground would be symbolically important and set a precedent. Sequent was ready with an answer.
That is a matter of discussion between your people and the Jarapta.
His instructions were clear. Until the federal government decided how to respond to the Rindaloo demand, no additional humans would be allowed to land on Paradise. There was a bit of wiggle room in the instructions if the Jarapta insisted the humans must get off their ship at Paradise. In that case, the humans could be temporarily accommodated on the space station or aboard one of the Ruhar fleet's transport ships. Whatever happened would be negotiated between the Ruhar and their patrons. Humans would not be part of the discussion. There would be no more boots on the ground.
I am sure you understand this is a delicate issue.
Sequent's face took on a pained expression. The fleet very much wanted the technology upgrades offered by Earth, even the limited teaser package that would only improve the effectiveness of Ruhar stealth fields.
We do intend to continue talks about technology transfers.
Hans suppressed a smile. Of course the hamsters wanted a part of the vast technology database that humans had acquired. They wanted the information, plus assistance in understanding and using the advanced tech. On behalf of UNEF, he had been negotiating to provide a package of selected technologies to the Ruhar in exchange for a limited alliance.
Please understand, I must consult with my government before talks can continue, given the changed circumstances.
That was his diplomatic way of saying you assholes are not getting something for nothing. A treaty with the Ruhar would be nice, but far less important than an alliance with their patrons, the Jarapta. What he feared was that if the Rindaloo had warned the Ruhar against making a deal with Earth, surely the Spiders had also advised the Beetles not to sign any sort of mutual defense treaty with humans. UNEF needed to know about this disturbing development. With a weary groan he kept to himself, he anticipated yet another flight across thousands of light years. Shuttle diplomacy was much easier when all he had to do was fly between Geneva and New York. The Jarapta were very nice to provide a ship for him, and the crew was always polite.
But it was an alien ship, and he could never truly relax when he was being transported across the stars.
Senior Captain Gamaria sat stiffly on the couch in her temporary office aboard the space dock where the battle-damaged ships of her destroyer squadron were awaiting repairs. She was mentally preparing herself for a meeting with an Inquisitor when she expected to be harshly criticized for losing a precious technology demonstrator. The alibi had been stolen right in front of her, and she had failed to prevent the theft or to blow up the ship before it and its priceless technology could be taken by the enemy. It was an embarrassing disaster, and she would get the blame. It did not matter that the other two demonstrator ships had been assigned heavier escorts, or that the foolish public tour had been canceled after the incident, or that she had warned Homefleet that the alibi was too exposed, too valuable a target for the enemy to ignore. Her career was likely over, the Inquisitor's report a mere formality in the process. So she was shocked when the office door slid open without warning and a figure wearing a captain's uniform and a smirky grin greeted her.
Good morning, Senior Captain.
She didn't know what to say. Certainly she recognized the person standing in the doorway, though she had never spoken with Captain Scarandum.
Oh, fuck, she groaned. I was expecting a visit from the Inquisitor's office. That's bad enough. Now ECO is involved?
Scarandum leaned casually against the doorframe.
You will have the pleasure of meeting an Inquisitor later today. However, that is nothing to worry about.
Nothing to worry about? She cocked her head. Have you ever been interrogated by an Inquisitor?
Scarandum's grin faded for a moment.
More times than I can count, Senior Captain. I can assure you that this afternoon's meeting with an Inquisitor is merely a formality. It is part of the show.
Show? What show?
The show for the benefit of the Bosphorak and their patrons and allies.
The Bosphorak don't have allies. They have rivals and enemies.
You know what I mean.
You didn't answer my question. What show?
Our cover story. Are you going to invite me to sit down? Senior Captain.
He held up a bag with one hand.
Oh, hell. Come in, she waved disgustedly.
I come bearing gifts, he said, reaching into the bag and pulling out a bottle of vintage Floon. This is your preferred brand, I believe.
Rolling her eyes, she said, I am not bothering to ask how you know that.
Nothing underhanded, I assure you. We simply asked your staff. Do you want...
She snatched the bottle away and examined it. Indeed, it was a rare vintage.
To what do I owe this pleasure? Unfortunately, I do not have any Burgoge for you.
Ah,
Scarandum dipped into the bag again and extracted a bottle of Burgoge, which was only 3/4 full.
This, he explained, is a gift to myself.
You are very generous, she snorted.
The home fleet is paying the tab. He indicated both bottles.
Does the home fleet know they are paying?
They are very busy. It's best not to bother them with details.
Anyway, will you please tell me what the hell is going on? Command is on my ass about losing the demonstrator despite,
like I said, don't worry about it.
It's not your career.
You will receive a commendation for your actions, though, sadly, that will have to remain a secret for the time being.
A commendation?
Yes. You displayed excellent judgment as we hoped.
Gamaria cracked the seal on the bottle of Floon, and the office was filled with a tantalizing scent. It was tantalizing to her. To Scarandum, it probably smelled like furniture wax. Opening a drawer, she removed 2 glasses and slid one toward the ECO agent. After they had taken a sip of their preferred beverage, Gamaria slapped the table.
The truth. Captain, now.
I will tell you all you are cleared to know. None of this leaves your office.
He raised an eyebrow.
Understood. No one would believe me anyway.
That's probably true, he chuckled. We wanted the enemy to capture the alibi. That is why we publicized the tour schedule and Home Fleet assigned a thin escort screen.
You want
the Bosphorak to steal technology we are paying the humans for? Not necessarily the Bosphorak. It could have been the Theranin, the Esselgin, any of the second-tier enemy clients. He shrugged. Whichever one of them sees the alibi, the technology is certain to be taken by the Maxulks, and eventually be stolen or purchased by other clients within that coalition. She cocked her head again, thinking that perhaps she should have begun drinking earlier. ECO wishes our enemies to possess technology that we don't even have yet? No, that's the point. Senior Captain, the alibi was a Trojan horse, except there were no real people inside it. She blinked at him blankly, her antenna drooping. What is a horse? It is an earth animal. A large one, he sputtered, realizing that he was likely one of the few Giraptha who had ever heard that human legend. Perhaps it is better if I describe the alibi as a time bomb. We have not been able to confirm it yet, but it is almost certain that little ship exploded and took at least a star carrier with it, hopefully more. So, she took a sip of Floon, savoring the subtle mix of flavors. This was all about blowing up a single star carrier? No, he snorted. That was a bonus. Before the alibi self-destructed, the Bosphorak would have downloaded sensitive data from the computer core, downloaded details of the new technology. Then I do not see how the data is also a time bomb. Scarandum took a very self-satisfied swig of Burgoge. The enemy doesn't know it, but that bomb has already exploded. You see, Senior Captain, the technical specifications in the alibi's databanks were subtly altered to make it useless. Any attempt to build components based on that data will lead to frustrating failure, but the Bosphorak will know the technology does work. So their scientists will spend years going down the wrong path, wasting enormous time and effort, and delaying any actual progress. Meanwhile, he leaned back on the couch, we will leap past all of them, thanks to our new human friends. Well, Damaria knocked back the remaining Floon in her glass. Shit, all this was an ECO operation? Yes. Since the technology is new to us, how did we know how to... We didn't. We suggested a deception to the humans and their elder AI. The AI was delighted to help us, so it... Excuse me, he... Scarandum corrected himself with a nervous glance at the ceiling. He was eager for an opportunity to screw with our enemies. Gamaria leaned forward on the desk. You met the AI? Yes. Not actually. He communicates through an avatar, of course. Of course. What is it he like? I believe the humans describe him as an insufferably arrogant asshole. She looked at the ECO agent with the side eye. Are they correct? Yes, Scarandum grinned. But no more than many people I've met. And the AI has strong justification for his arrogance. The humans call him Skippy? Apparently that is a disrespectful nickname. It might originally have been intended as disrespect, though I am certain the humans recognized his value long ago. She snorted. From what I have read, the humans would be extinct by now if not for help from the AI. The truth must be more complicated than that, Scarandum warned with a raised antenna. Skippy somehow needs the humans. Or some of them. We do not fully understand the relationship. Clearly, the AI sees substantial value in a partnership with humans. Also, it should be noted that humans without the aid of an elder AI have been impressively, even annoyingly, successful, despite their severe disadvantages. It was her turn to smile. You refer to the Mavericks? Yes, Scarandum admitted with a frown. That damned Perkins woman. I would like to meet her, Gamaria said, taking a sip of Floon. Anyone who managed to manipulate the ECO had to be admired. Are all your operations like this?
It was fairly typical. Nothing special, he said with false modesty. I do apologize that you could not be informed ahead of time. She scowled at him.
Regardless of a secret commendation in my file, I have a mark against myself in the official records.
That, he waved a hand, has been taken care of. Officially, you will be placed on administrative leave, pending the Inquisitor's report. Take some time off, but not too much time. When the investigation concludes and the report is issued, you will be given command of a cruiser squadron attached to the 16 fleet.
Is this for real? She asked warily. Or more ECO bullshit?
For real. It's all arranged. Really, Senior Captain, we are extremely grateful for your good judgment. If you had attempted a useless gesture like a suicide attack to blow up the alibi, it would have screwed up the whole plan.
Cruiser captains are supposed to be aggressive, she reminded him.
Yes, the best cruiser squadrons are led by a commander who is aggressive, but not stupidly so. When I said we are pleased, I meant ECO and the home fleet leadership.
She sat back on her couch. Did home fleet know about this in advance?
The people who needed to know, yes.
Really, Senior Captain.
He stood up and slid the bottle of Burgos across the desk toward her.
Relax. Enjoy your leave. You might want to use the time to study the latest thinking about cruiser squadron tactics.
Thank you, she blinked, still not quite believing the completely unexpected turn of events.
I do not drink, Burgos.
Keep it for me, he winked. We might meet again.
Not if I can help it, she muttered.
Ah, but that's the point. He paused in the doorway. You won't know ECO is involved until I am in your office again.
One last question, if I may.
What?
Did anyone in the ethics office wager that aliens would steal one of the demonstrator ships?
Not that I know of.
Scarandum's expression turned serious.
That is a major disadvantage to this job. We have valuable information that we can't use. You asked whether I ever met with an Inquisitor. Their office has a whole section dedicated to monitoring our wagering activity, and damn it, they don't take bribes. Inquisitors, he shook his head sadly, are not civilized.